Dr. Ken Boa is president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. His talk today is on Understanding Islam. What do you know about this major religion and how it began? To begin our study, here's our speaker, Dr. Ken Boa.
I'm calling this presentation Understanding Islam. Now, about 4 or 5 years ago, Bill Ibson and I created a DVD called Understanding Muslims. But more specifically, this new material that we've put together asks the question about the identification of Islam per se and focuses on the question of whether it has been hijacked by terrorists and some of the tough questions that surface. We certainly know that there is a tension, indeed a mystery, when we hear two different approaches to Islam. On the one hand, we hear people saying Islam is a religion of peace, do we not? On the other hand, we'll also hear people saying that it's a militant religion. So who's right? And why is there this discrepancy? So I thought it would be very helpful for us to look at it from both points of view. And I want to start off then from the standpoint of our national impression of what this was all about, especially on a day that all of us will remember. If you were alive and old enough, you'll remember the day when John F. Kennedy was killed. If you're old enough to do that, you'll know what you were doing and where you were. You'll also know where you were on this day when the U.S. was attacked. I can vividly remember precisely where I was and who called me up and told me that I need to look at the television. And then the horror that I had when I saw these two buildings go down. It was a haunting, unprecedented image on virtually every television network. And if you happened to have visited St. Paul's Episcopal Church, which is located across the street from the Twin Towers, and which became a relief center for the various police and fire and rescue workers, you surely would have seen the walls filled with thank you notes and posters of those who sought its sanctuary. But if you looked at the timeline of the attack on the display there, or on the account of attacks on the high construction fences surrounding Ground Zero, you would see no mention of Islam, per se, nor any mention whatsoever of the purpose of the attack. The perpetrators were neutrally referred to as the hijackers, and the critical questions of who and why were left at that point to the imagination of the viewers. But who were these people who committed this horrendous crime? Why did they do it? And when did we ever hurt them? And, of course, the obvious question that people immediately began to ask, when is this going to happen again? And so, will our children or grandchildren, we ask, see these kinds of acts of terrorism once again in America? Will it stop or can it be stopped? These are all questions that one raises. But let me tell you where we must begin as followers of Jesus. If we claim to be followers of Jesus, I begin here. There's no other place to begin. I begin with this image of love. That God is love, and if we see the great commands of the New Testament, what are those great commands? Which are a summary of the law. You shall love the Lord your God in what way? With all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength, which is inside out. And secondly, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus, in his great Sermon on the Mount, told us to love our enemies, and indeed to pray for those who persecute you. Not an easy thing to do. By the way, it's extremely important to note he didn't tell us to like our enemies, but he told us to love them. And love always seeks the highest interest in the one who is beloved. And the highest interest of a person who doesn't know Jesus is for them to come to know him. Would you not agree? So when I think about people in this situation, my call is to listen to the word of Jesus. And my interaction with fellow believers, but also people who are atheists, Muslims, Jews, Hindus. It's to be one of love, choosing the highest good in the one who is loved. Now, there are some who have the sentiment in America, like this fellow who owns this pickup truck, everything I ever needed to know about Islam I learned on 9/11. And this certainly is one approach to understanding Muslims, but it's not necessarily a well-informed view of this very complex religion. Now, our approach instead is going to be to look at what seems to be the hot topic since 9/11, namely, is Islam a religion of peace or not, and why? And then I want to look after that at its history. We need to know something about its history. We need to know as well as about the basic teachings of Islam. What are the teachings? What, furthermore, does the Quran actually say? I want to have first-hand investigation of what the Quran really says so we can see for itself. And I want to be fair. I don't want to be one-sided, but I want to treat the material carefully and with fairness. And then I want to examine what our response ought to be. Now, we all saw this kind of image on television and in the news, and with 3,000-plus innocent victims killed with two planes, another hijacked plane striking the Pentagon, a fourth plane crashing on the way to the White House, that gives many people a data point, and several data points, as to whether or not Islam is a religion of peace. So right now we're looking at the argument that it is, in fact, according to this perspective, not a religion of peace, but a militant religion. And then I want to contrast that with the opposite viewpoint in just a moment. Now, some of you may remember the events of 1979 that this Time magazine cover commemorates. Islam, the militant revival, it said, when the Islamic religious leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini, overthrew the government of the Shah of Iran. And the Ayatollah is pictured here on the cover the following year, in the year 1980, where Time magazine sarcastically presents him as the man of the year. And their article about him is entitled, "The Mystic Who Lit the Fires of Hatred, Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini Seized His Nation and Shook All Islam." This goes back decades now. Then in 1985, you may remember the TWA hijacking done by Muslims. And then in 2001, of course, we see this image of the work of the hijackers. Now, these are only a few representations. There are many other, just Time magazine covers alone that depict it. But at any rate, there are just a few more I want to point out. We saw this cover certainly in 2001, Facing the Fury, it was called, and also, How Real is the Threat? So this was a growing issue of increasing frequency and concern. And this is exactly, of course, the question, how real is the threat today? And we have to ask this question of whether this thing will continue, what's its future? And of course, we saw multiple covers then depicting Osama bin Laden, who continues to elude the most advanced forces of our military. You'll also remember someone that I always remember when I'm at the airport. You'll remember him, Richard Reed, perhaps the shoe bomber. I remember him every time I take my shoes off in the airport security because of his attempted act of terrorism in 2001, where on American Airlines Flight 63, born a British citizen, Reed secretly filled his shoes with explosives, but because of the rainy day or because of his perspiration, the fuse was damp and it refused to be lit. The smell of the burning matches caught the attention of the other passengers, and he was subdued and then later injected with a tranquilizer for a flight to Boston. But ultimately, this means that now tens of millions of people are inconvenienced at every airport for this particular reason, for fear that that could happen again. We witnessed another data point, the 2004 Madrid commuter train bombings, which injured 1,500 people. It killed 191 people. And again, why? These are civilians. These are not military opponents. Who did this? What could possibly motivate them to kill like this? And again, the official investigation by the Spanish judiciary determined that the attacks were indeed directed by an Al-Qaeda terrorist cell. Also in 2004, in Beslan, Russia, there was the witness of the Beslan school massacres, where Muslim jihadists killed 334 people, including 186 children, as this image commemorates some of the victims. In fact, one of the survivors of this massacre captured some footage on a camera phone of the Muslim jihadists stringing up bombs across the gym floor between the basketball hoops, with the 300-plus victims frightened and huddled within the school gym. Now, this video, available on YouTube, shows this and the Muslim terrorists letting 11 mothers with infants go, but only mothers who had a son or a daughter, whom they were forced to leave behind in the gym to be blown up with the rest of the children and mothers. Again, why? How is it possible? Again, in England, the year 2005, the London bombings, coordinated by four Muslim suicide bombers on London's public transport system at rush hour, left 56 dead, 700 injured. Also in the same year, 2005, in Denmark, the world witnessed riots all over the Muslim world protesting these 12 Danish political cartoons. Some of them escalated into violence with police firing on the crowds, well, resulting in over 100 deaths, as well as Muslims setting fire to the Danish embassies in Syria, Lebanon, and Iran, storming European buildings and desecrating the Danish, Dutch, Norwegian, and German flags in Gaza City. Many Muslim leaders across the globe issued death threats against these Danish cartoonists for making these kinds of portrayals of their prophet Muhammad. In addition to these suicide bombings, these death threats, these killings, the New York Times reported later in 2005 that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, was speaking to an audience of about 4,000 students at a program called The World Without Zionism, and said that Israel must be wiped out from the map of the world. He added, and Allah willing, he said, with the force of Allah behind it, we shall soon experience a world without the United States and Zionism. So this was a very clear and forceful statement. As you know, he and other Muslims view America, with its historical support of Israel as a nation, at least in the past, to be Zionists, as well as militant crusaders because of the crusades conducted in the 10th to the 13th centuries. And we'll comment about that a little bit later on. The Fort Hood shooting was a mass shooting that took place on November 5th, 2009 at Fort Hood, the most populous U.S. military base in the world. Located just outside Killeen, Texas, killing 13 people, wounding 30 others. And while screaming, by the way, Allah Akbar, meaning God is great. The perpetrator of this U.S. massacre was Nidal Malik Hassan, a U.S. Army major, ironically serving as a psychiatrist. And they were saying that the media basically tried to just write this off as being mere mental imbalance, when he himself, by his own connections and claims, was in fact doing this in the name of Islam. And more recently, in 2009, the infamous Christmas Day bomber, Umar Farouk Abdul Muttalab, was a Muslim suicide bomber recruited in London to set off a bomb that nearly killed 300 passengers. Now, on board this flight, this Nigerian citizen attempted to detonate plastic explosives hidden in his underwear while on board Northwest Airlines Flight 253 en route from Amsterdam to Detroit on Christmas Day. Like the shoe bomber, he failed to detonate his explosive and only burned himself and those who were in the process of subduing him. But again, why? Why would he try to detonate a bomb that would kill himself and 300 innocent victims? And so we see again, and this could be multiplied again and again and again with so many other illustrations that we could have, the Lockerbie situation and all of these. What's interesting, if you look at the FBI's website showing their most wanted terrorists as of January of 2011, you'll find that not only are the majority of them Muslim, in fact, all of them are except for one. And so again, this is another data point for those who want to argue that Islam is in fact, at its core, militant. Again, we're going to see the opposite perspective in just a moment. We continually hear about the suicide bombers and the terrorist attacks in Israel by multiple Islamic groups such as Hamas and the Gaza Strip and Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and also others. In this image, what we see here are the Hamas suicide bombers, and they're equipped not only with their explosives, but what else is inside their belt? Copies of the Quran. So this is, again, an ideological issue. This is not just something secondary, at least not from their point of view. Finally, one of the several websites today that watches and catalogs the activity of these jihadists worldwide, and this particular one, Jihad Watch, reports that over 9,000 violent acts of terror have been committed by jihadists since 9/11. Many of which were done against fellow Muslims. You have to bear this in mind. Many of them are actually against fellow Muslims who disagree with their particular position. So we have this evidence, among much other evidence, that clearly would seem to indicate that Islam is not a religion of peace, that it is unambiguously militant. So how could anyone possibly dispute this obvious fact? And yet, there are contrary opinions that would argue that Islam is a peaceful religion. So we go to the opposite side of the coin. And let's listen, give a fair hearing now to that side of the coin. You may have seen a sign like this, which says in Arabic, "Islam is peace." And here is a gentle-looking Muslim man embracing another one, with a sign again declaring that Islam is peace. And here's a woman who looks a little more Western, holding a sign that Islam means peace. So these declarations completely conflict with the idea of Islam being a militant religion. Here's a British website, by the way, with a web address, www.islamispeace.org.uk. And their message that Islam is a religion of peace is advertised across London's double-decker buses, even today. And in this part of the website, they actually show some of the misconceptions that they believe people have about Islam. Now, Dr. Malina Lodi, the Pakistani ambassador to the United States, who's also a Muslim, in 2001, she was on the Oprah show, and she spoke on what was called Islam 101. And she said, "I would like to reassure the American public that Islam does not preach violence." Now, this is certainly a plain and simple statement that couldn't be said more clearly. It doesn't preach violence. That's the end of it. And then we have Queen Rania. She is not some sort of Vogue model, but is actually the Queen of Jordan, married to King Abdullah, and in my opinion represents one of the best examples of Islam today and embraces and exploits that role as an ambassador to the world for Islam. Note that she looks Western. She's not wearing a hijab or a veil, but could fit in anywhere in America. She speaks English very well. And she utilizes a modern social media, the modern media such as Twitter and YouTube, as a way of promoting intercultural dialogue by calling on young people around the world to engage in a global dialogue to dismantle stereotypes of Muslims and the Arab world. And you can look her up on YouTube to view her personal charming style that defends peaceful Islam. And here's what she, as a Muslim woman, married to a Muslim in a predominantly Muslim country, has to say about Islam. "Do terrorists," she asks, "represent the true teaching of Islam?" "No, absolutely not. The Quran," she goes on to say, "teaches compassion, charity, forgiveness, the pursuit of knowledge, and humility." If that is the case, then who could object to these wonderful traits? Now, Queen Rania appeared on television during the Clinton Global Summit, where she spoke on Islam. And she commented, "Let's be frank. Most terrorists' attacks in recent history have been conducted by Muslims. But they," she says, "are misrepresentatives of Islam." And so in her view, the terrorists, who are almost exclusively Muslim, simply misrepresent the true teaching of Islam. They've hijacked, they've distorted Islam for their own means. And this view is certainly a possibility. There have certainly been many misrepresentatives of Christianity, for example, throughout history, including the Crusaders and those who instigated the Spanish Inquisition and those who burned witches and so forth. This is parenthetical, but I noticed that those are always the same three objections that you get in the last 2,000 years of church history. One would expect a few more than that, but those are the primary objections one gets. But at any rate, naturally, we can certainly say that there has been a great deal of hypocrisy amongst Christians, and not all Christians represent the faith in appropriate manners. And so we could certainly say that her explanation could, in this light, be credible and plausible. It'd be interesting, however, to hear what the terrorists think about her comment about them misrepresenting Islam. Now, Queen Rania is certainly not the only high-profile politician who defends Islam. America's ally Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of the UK, plainly stated that based upon England's best intelligence, Islam, he said, is a religion of peace. And echoing Queen Rania's view of the Islamic terrorists, went on to say, "Islam is far removed from the crude and warped distortion of the extremists." So the Prime Minister of England offered us this data point. The terrorists were merely extremists living out a crude and warped distortion of true Islam. And America's own former president, George W. Bush, publicly declared on the White House website that Islam is peace. And this is reported on that site for all to see. Makes that very clear. Then in 2009, President Obama, who himself grew up in the Muslim country of Indonesia, spoke to the Turkish National Assembly and said this about the Muslim faith. Let me say this as clearly as I can. The United States is not and never will be at war with Islam. In fact, our partnership with the Muslim world is critical in rolling back a fringe ideology that people of all faiths reject. So we have both Republican and Democratic presidential leadership publicly declaring Islam to be a religion of peace and labeling the terrorists as a fringe ideology, a distortion of Islam, and yet the terrorists, if not much of the Muslim world today, vehemently disagree with President Obama, passionately criticizing that the United States is indeed at war with Islam. Not only that, but most Islamic terrorists would say that Muslims like Queen Rania are distorting the true nature of Islam. They're the ones distorting it and the teachings of Muhammad, and as such, they themselves are rejected by Allah and worthy of death. So thus we find ourselves lost in contradictions. We've witnessed horrific acts of Islamic terrorism on our own soil in New York City and Washington, D.C., and we hear constant reports of these suicide bombers that the world has witnessed over 9,000 Islamic acts of terrorism, not just in one Middle Eastern country, but literally all over the globe, and yet our politicians assure us that Islam is a religion of peace. Again, maybe the terrorists have hijacked Islam, maybe they have distorted it. Or maybe they are the true expression of the religion. How can we unravel this mystery? How can one Muslim then say that Islam is black and the other say that it's white? Why does such a simple question regarding Islam being a religion of peace polarize Muslims and seem to be enshrouded in contradiction and mystery? I want to suggest four reasons in my study that really help me understand why there is this discrepancy. I think there are four reasons why this is the case, why there is this mystery. The first reason for this confusion is that because Islam is not monolithic, there is no single answer to this question that properly represents all Muslims. Indeed, Islam is replete with varying sects, varying schools of thought, varying movements. There's no single figure or position that represents Islam. They're deeply divided amongst themselves and deeply disagree with each other about the true nature of Islam. For example, within the Sunni sect of Islam, the Wahhabi sect sees themselves as a corrective agent in Islam and are one of the most violent groups within Islam. In fact, the Wahhabis consider only themselves to be true Muslims, and they regard all other so-called Muslims as fakes who have distorted the true nature of Islam. This is why many of the suicide bombings are aimed at Muslims, to punish and purge Islam of its false adherents. Of course, the Shia, as well as the Sufi sects, completely disagree with the Wahhabis, and they represent the two other major sects of Islam that we will discuss later. Further, there are the Qajarite and the Kalam sects of Islam. And not unlike Christianity, Islam is highly fragmented. Islam is not monolithic by any means. The lack of one voice for Islam is one of the reasons why such a cacophony of opinions exists about the actual nature of Islam and the terrorists who act in its name. Well, having said that, I would say that one thing that unifies all followers of Christ, whether they are Orthodox, whether they are Protestant, whether they are Catholic, is that all can affirm the same creeds. Fundamentally, the Nicene and the Apostles' Creed are agreed upon, so that level of discrepancy is not as great. At any rate, so that denominations certainly prevail, but it's not the fundamental violence against the creeds themselves at large. Now, a second reason, besides the fact that Islam is not monolithic, that causes this contradiction, is the principle of abrogation. Most people do not know about this principle, but let me try to clarify this for you because it's very important. Abrogation means effectively to abolish by formal or official means, to annul, to repeal, or to abrogate a law. Now, the Quran itself makes an allowance for Allah to repeal his own verses, thus allowing new verses to supersede or replace older ones. Specifically, Surah number 2, verse 106, which I'm showing here copied straight from the Quran, with the Arabic there as well, makes this allowance. It reads this way: whatever message we abrogate, which means, again, repeal, or cause to be forgotten, that is to say, to delete or whatever, we bring one better than it, or one like it. Knowest thou not that Allah is possessor of power over all things? And so that this verse then means that Allah and the Prophet reserve the right to repeal or to delete verses and to replace them with better or similar verses. Now, the rationale for this change is given in Allah's omnipotence. Basically, Allah can nullify and offer improved verses at will. So, for example, the command to pray towards Jerusalem was nullified by later verses to pray towards Mecca in Surah 142 to 144. Though neither city is specifically named, it's obvious from the history and context what they are. So there was this change that took place, and one abrogated the other. In other words, it looks this way. The main point with abrogation is that in situations wherein verses contradict one another, the early verses are overridden by the later verses. And so what takes place then is that abrogation can cause major interpretation problems, as you can well imagine, particularly as it relates to the issue of militancy. And this is because Muhammad allegedly received revelations from Allah through the angel Gabriel in two different locations, Mecca and later in Medina. Now, the verses that were recorded during Muhammad's peaceful earlier time are the Meccan verses, and those are more peaceful in their nature. On the contrary, when Muhammad began his military conquests around the Arabian Peninsula, the verses revealed to him by Allah were militant, and these were the later Medina verses, where he moved to. And since these verses were revealed later than the Meccan verses, they would then, according to this law of abrogation, supersede or replace the Meccan verses that would contradict them. And so when proponents of Islam as a religion of peace quote peaceful verses of the Quran, they're generally quoting earlier Meccan verses and ignoring the later Medina verses. They want to emphasize the peaceful side of Islam as prescribed by the Quran. On the other hand, militant Muslims like the Wahhabis take their cues from the Medina verses, which according to Surah 2106 that we have just read, supersede the peaceful earlier Meccan verses. Now, the principle of abrogation then is, I think, one of the key causes of contradictory opinion about the true nature of Islam. It's a question of emphasis. Effectively, to be fair and consistent with what that verse means, the later trumps the earlier. And so, on this basis, then, the Quran would clearly favor the interpretation of those who would embrace its principle of abrogation. Any questions on that? I want to make sure we're all together on that, make sure it's all clear. Yes?
Who is the they that makes the decision that it's going to be changed?
Who's the they? It's no they. It's the Quran itself which has this claim. So the Quran itself says if there's a contradiction, you take the later verses over the former verses. It's not someone who came along later. It's in its own, the own book is its own authority for making that claim. Yes. So it gives us, indeed, the Quran itself gives us a principle of interpretation, you see, that if consistently followed, then would say the later verses must trump those verses that would contradict them. That's the principle, yes.
But that's about interpretation. Somebody has to make the interpretation.
Well, the verse is fairly clear. It'd be very difficult for me, going back to that verse, to see it meaning much of anything else, and it's not out of its context. It says that Allah has the right to change his mind, and that the later ones change are the ones that would be used, not the earlier ones. There's no modern-day author, so what we have here is the whole Quran was revealed, presumably, over this period of time, and by Muhammad, actually to Muhammad, through the angel Gabriel. It's not something that was then later than modified that much. Although, having said that, there were different early editions that were then reduced down to one. Yes.
Ken, is there a handy cross-reference to the older and the later?
Yeah, there's a pretty, again, there's an understanding of which verses and which surahs were written earlier, which surahs were written later, so that there's a way of determining those. And consistently, the Meccan verses are more peaceful, the Medina verses more militant, which would actually reflect the history of that time. When we look at the history, the background history, we'll see that. So I'm merely saying that the later trumps the earlier. Yes.
When did the 20 years occur within the Christian calendar?
Oh, we're going to be talking about that. It's a good question. But because he died in 632, so these would have been revealed from this period of time from about 622, 592, but I'll give you those exact dates, yeah, so particularly when those began. And he was born in 570 and lived until 632, and the revelations particularly started around 692, so right in that period of time. All right, let's move on to the third issue then. And this third one, I think, also helps me understand it. The fact that, A, that there's radical difference, not minor, but fundamental difference on these various groups. And furthermore, that there is this principle of abrogation that is, when consistently followed, would indicate that the Medina verses trump the Meccan verses. But the third reason for, I think, this web of contradiction about the nature of Islam has to do with the interpretation issue of how do we interpret the Quran? Do we take it figuratively? Do we take it in a plain, normal understanding, in a more in a literal manner? And this resides in this issue, like Hinduism, Judaism, Christianity, just about any other religion in the world. There are going to be varying degrees of practice and commitment to faith and to its holy writings. We see this across the board. Not every religion seems to be comprised of people who take three different stances. Let me call them, first of all, the secularist position, secondly, the moderate position, and the third position. I'm trying to avoid a pejorative term like fundamentalist. So the word I've come up with is the word consistent. You with me here? They believe that they're being consistent with the actual book itself and with the practices that are revealed in that book, and they take it not figuratively, but in a plain, normal understanding. And that helps me with this. Secularists, as the name would imply, are more secular than they are religious. They're Muslims or Jews or Christians in name only, and they are nominally committed to their religion, and thus would have actually fairly low knowledge of what their scriptures, as one would expect, actually teach. Moderates, on the other hand, have a bit more commitment to the teachings of the religion, and as such would possess a moderate or medium knowledge about their scriptures, certainly more than the secularists. I certainly have more knowledge in that respect, but less than those who would take the third position, which would be consistent, and their level of commitment seems greater, and more specifically, their knowledge on the whole of their scriptures would on the whole be, obviously, this is taken as a group, be larger, greater. And so this group then would be more deeply committed. And most religions have problematic passages that those both inside and outside of the faith would find difficult to understand or obey. And secularists are hardly familiar with these kinds of passages, but if they are, they'd, as I said earlier, tend to dismiss them as perhaps figurative. For example, the Arabic word jihad, now we've used that several times. Most people don't know what it means. The word jihad means simply struggle. That's what the word means, struggle. Now, if you took it literally, it would be an actual violent struggle, something like war or something of that sort. But one could take it figuratively, as these do, and they would say that this is an internal struggle. The jihad is within. This is what they'll say. And so they take what appears to be a very clear verse that teaches that there is, in fact, a war, or that you're to do this or that to your enemy, and they'd say this merely is figurative. The same would be more likely the case for the moderate follower as well, who would more likely interpret it in a figurative manner. Whereas the person who takes the consistent position would tend to interpret them in harmony with the way they would interpret the rest of the holy writings in their common or natural or literal sense. That is to say, the plain common meaning of the words, unless there's obvious indication that they're being used figuratively. So because the Quran commands women to dress modestly, they dress modestly, both in color and form, via their veils, or perhaps even going so far as the full body covering black burqas that may or may not even show their eyes. And thus, by contrast, Queen Rania of Jordan shows herself not to be in that position, but rather, as she herself says, to be a moderate Muslim, wears no veil, let alone a burqa. She's explicitly stated on one of her YouTube videos that she's a moderate Muslim, and naturally, too, then she will sympathize with the earlier, more peaceful Meccan verses. And as such, those who take a consistent position would view jihad in its plain and obvious sense. When the Quran commands slaying unbelievers, that's not an internal struggle, but rather precisely what the faithful think it means, and they will look at verses dealing with jihad directly from the Quran in this manner, and so we'll explore that. Now, I want to be clear here, and this is very important. The majority of people in these religions, whether they be Christian, Hindu, Jewish, or Muslim, tend to be secularists or moderates. We could certainly say that they would be more inclined to a more peaceful approach rather than the minority. Only the minority would take that consistent position, as is the case with all other major world religions, it seems. I would estimate that those who take that consistent, literal position, who would thereby be more specifically jihadists, would be more like 15%. But the interesting thing is their influence will be disproportionate to their numbers, precisely because of a more fully embraced ideology, a more passionately held ideology would make a difference, and so there'd be a disproportionate influence. Now let me give a fourth, and let me make sure we're together on that. Any questions on that before I move on? I want to make sure we're together. Okay, this is fairly straightforward. Yes, Murray?
I just want to say that the exact same pattern is percentages are true with Judaism as well.
Yeah, I think that's why I think probably Christianity. I'm going to guess in our culture about 15% really are consistent. This is why I like that word more than fundamentalist. I don't mind being called a consistent follower of Jesus, but I don't want to be a fighting fundamentalist because of all the pejorative baggage that bears. However, I'd say about 15% are consistent both with Jews, with Christians, with Muslims. Who knows, probably with the other religions as well.
Would you say that the consistent most accurately define the religion?
Yes, I think the most consistent, when I use the word consistent, I mean that they are more consistent with the actual teachings of their holy book. They live more consistently and they believe more consistently. They take it in its plain way and they seek to follow it out. And that's why I'm using that word consistent, which is not pejorative, but actually a rather good description of exactly that. They are the ones who, in my view, are closer to that reality. At least that's how they perceive it as well. Now, the fourth reason why it's lost in contradiction, why there is this struggle and of why does it appear to be one thing on the one hand and then another on the other hand, is a principle that causes confusion, the principle of taqiyya, or lying. And this is in part based upon Surah 3, verse 28. Now, that Arabic word means to prevent or to guard against, and it conveys the idea that Muslims are actually permitted to lie as a preventive measure. Lying was actually a common practice for Muhammad, who often lied and instructed his followers to do the same. Surah 16:106 even allows Muslims to falsely deny their faith when forced to do so, so long as they profess their faith in their hearts. You see, that's an important principle. In general, however, Muslims are permitted to lie in three different situations. Three main: in jihad, as I already mentioned, to reconcile people. Secondly, between spouses to keep the peace. And third, basically to reconcile people as well. And so as such, uttering insincere oaths can be permissible, which is of course quite problematic for countries signing peace treaties with an Islamic nation. systematic lying and deception then actually become acceptable practices in jihad against unbelievers as an actual principle of warfare. It's very important that we understand this. Therefore, propaganda, misinformation, disinformation, plain deceit can be common practices. Further, the rhetoric of Islamic activists may not always be the whole truth. Frequent lies from the Islamic world to non-Muslims add intentional confusion to the non-Muslim world. Let me illustrate this by, again, the president of Iran. In one speech that he made, he said, "Our message is the message of peace and brotherhood with all nations, with all people. We love the American people as we love our own." I feel like I've come from a different planet when I hear that, because at the same time, he incites worldwide animosity against America, as expressed in Iran and many Muslim countries, like this American flag burning in Tehran. And while he considers America to be the great Satan, as depicted in this sidewalk mural in Tehran, and while this full-size building mural, mocking the American flag written with the English words, "Down with the USA," But Ahmadinejad, when speaking truthfully, has said, "And Allah willing, with the force of Allah behind it, we shall soon experience a world without the United States and Zionism." Now, which one is it going to be? For him, there's no contradiction between these statements. Why? Because the first is jihadist propaganda. It's useful for various purposes. And he'll normally say that in English. In Arabic, he may say something very different. And that's a statement that he would actually believe. Now, let me make my indisputable key point. And this is, I want you to hear this very carefully before we leave this section, and why Islam seems to be so full of contradictions. I want to say, first of all, that most Muslims really are peaceful. They're not unlike the average American in their desire for peace and harmony and being left alone to live a quiet life. However, this is not to say that the teachings of the Quran are peaceful. But we're going to examine that matter later. You all tracking with me there? So I'm saying then that there can be mixed signals here. Now let me move on from here into my second point, which has to do with the history, and I want to develop that. It's very important that we know about the history and the teachings of their book, because without that embeddedness then, we're going to be subject to a superficial understanding of the religion. Let's take a look at the history and the beginnings. And effectively, it's the new kid on the block relative to other major world religions. Around approximately 2000 BC, Abram came on the scene, and that marked the official start of Judaism. And in 1500 BC, the Vedas were written approximately that time, and Hinduism begins. Taoism around 550 BC and Buddhism around 525 BC, followed by Shintoism around 300 BC. And then, of course, Christianity at the death of Christ, 33 AD. Just over 600 years after Christ, that's when Muhammad starts his relatively new religion of Islam, 622 AD. So as a latecomer, Islam views itself as a corrective ideology. It's important for us to see that. He is seen as the seal of the prophets, the final prophet. And as such, then, the Quran abrogates its own verses, as we saw, but also it nullifies Christianity and Judaism to the extent that there are contradictory claims with those religions, even though they appeared centuries before. So what does the word Islam mean, first of all? We need to understand what's going on when we consider the history. Many people assume that it means peace in the Arabic, but that's simply incorrect. It does not mean peace. The average person still thinks it means peace, because it sounds like salam, you know, shalom in the Hebrew. But instead, Islam means submission. It's important for us to understand what the word means. It means submission. Here's what it means. The duty of every Muslim is to submit to Allah. The overarching goal of Islam is global submission to Allah as the supreme being. And so when prayers are being offered, as you can see in this photograph, what's happening here is a carefully choreographed sequence of words and movements that are not spontaneous at all, but actually acts of submission rather than relationship. So it's important to see that. That's the major theme. I'll be saying later on that Allah can be known in terms of His will, but not as a person in any relational sense. Let me go on to say then that this word Muslim in the Arabic then would mean one who submits. An infidel, therefore, is one who does not show fidelity or faith towards Allah. So now allow me to give you a very begin, at least tonight. We don't have enough time to develop the whole, but I'll begin it tonight. A very brief history of Muhammad, who was born, as I said earlier, in 570 AD, and his original name was Abul Qasam, and his father was named Abdullah. And his father, Abdullah, died several weeks before his birth in Medina. And his mother, Amina, died while on the return journey from Medina when Muhammad was 6 years old. And thus he was orphaned at a tender age. He was then raised by his paternal grandfather, Abd al-Muttalib, until the age of 8. Now, many years before Muhammad's birth, it's important for us to understand that Abd al-Muttalib had established himself as an influential leader of the Arab tribe Quraysh in Mecca. And it's that tribe that took care of a holy sanctuary that was called the Kaaba, or Kaaba, which is pictured here. Now, at that time, the Kaaba was a house of idols with images of doves, even had images of Mary and Jesus and other gods that the Meccans worshipped. Unfortunately, however, Muhammad's grandfather only lived 2 years after Abdullah's death, and so he was only there for 2 years, and then his influence was replaced by his uncle Talib. And so he was raised by Uncle Talib, who was a caravan trader who ran routes from Mecca up into Egypt and Israel, and exposed Muhammad to this vocation, which would prove to be a strategic period of life for Muhammad from the age of 8 and following. So Muhammad is claimed to be a descendant of Ishmael through the lineage of his second son, Khidr. And the Quran claims that Abraham was not a Jew, but rather Abraham was a Muslim. In spite of the fact that Islam was not invented until 2,500 years after Abraham's life, Adam, Noah, Moses, even Jesus, all claimed to be Muslim. As you can see in this verse in the Quran, Abraham was not a Jew nor a Christian, but he was an upright man, a Muslim. And he was not one of the polytheists. Now you'll note how the Quran then makes some historical revisionism of the facts that should be reviewed as and seen as outrageous to the Jewish mind, as it is in complete opposition to the teachings about Abraham in the Torah. So the Torah makes it very clear that it's actually Abraham who offered up Isaac, and through him his descendants were named, rather than Ishmael. But at any rate, this verse is one of the many examples in which the Quran seeks to correct the theology of both Jews and of Christians. Now, we mentioned Muhammad's uncle Talib and his caravan route a moment ago. Now, Mecca was a city-state that was well connected to the caravan routes that Uncle Talib rode with Muhammad to Egypt, also on up to Israel, and also as far north as Syria. And thus, as a youth, Muhammad was exposed north and south to the trade routes and also to the polytheism of the Meccans, the Egyptians, to the monotheism of Judaism and of Christianity, to the paganism of the entire religion. He probably was not exposed specifically to churches as such, and the exposure to the scriptures themselves, the Bible themselves, is questionable. But at about the age of 25, something significant happened. Muhammad married Khadijah, and she was a wealthy widow, some 15 years his senior, about 40 years old at the time, who was also Uncle Talib's employer. And she was then, her cousin was apparently, by the way, a convert to Christianity, which is interesting, but in part because of Khadijah's wealth that afforded him the time to do so, at some point, Muhammad adopted the practice of meditating alone for several weeks every year in a cave on Mount Hira near Mecca. And it was in this cave, at the age of 40, in the year 610, that Muhammad claimed revelations from the angel Gabriel and his position as the last and most authoritative prophet. He would allegedly receive these revelations for the next 20 years, some in Mecca and the rest in Medina. Now, because Muhammad was illiterate, that is to say, was unable to write down any of the words of the angel Gabriel, he would recall the words of the angel Gabriel and thus recite the words from Allah. And therefore, these over the time became the basis for the Quran, and the word Quran literally means recitations. Now, of course, Muhammad could not, and in fact did not write it then, but some of his successors in later years produced various versions of his alleged recitations. Later on, those variations were eliminated and it was reduced down to one version. It's also interesting to note that the revelations were accompanied by seizures and foaming at the mouth. Thus, Muhammad himself feared that he was possessed by a jinn or a demon. But his wife Khadija dismissed Muhammad's fears and actually encouraged him to continue with the revelations and the recitations. Now, at the time of Muhammad, the Arabian people were polytheistic, and they were idolaters who had a pantheon of deities, including Allah, as well as angels and jinn, again, their term for demons. Now, Mecca was actually a religious center, and they had 360 shrines, including this small temple, the Kaaba, which houses the black stone, a meteorite allegedly brought by the angel Gabriel, and therefore revered by the Muslims. Now, the Muslims believe that this was constructed by Abraham after he sacrificed Ishmael, not Isaac, say the Muslims. The Jews got that fact wrong, they would claim, as an act of thanksgiving to Allah. Now, Muhammad reacted against this idolatry and concluded that Allah was alone the true God. This Kaaba, therefore, is in the center of Mecca and is still the central point of focus for Muslim pilgrims in coming to the mosque at Mecca. Now, Islam also teaches that Muhammad, as depicted here in the back of the angel Gabriel, miraculously took a night journey from Mecca and went to Jerusalem around the year 620 AD. And legend has it that he is said to have toured not only Jerusalem, but also even heaven and hell, and in heaven spoke with earlier Muslim prophets such as Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. And he preached his message of monotheism and judgment to the polytheists of Mecca, but you can imagine that local businessmen, depending upon pilgrimages to the idolatrous shrines in Mecca, would denounce him. Everything he taught was against the moral and social order of Mecca, and so they would reject Muhammad as a lunatic, a liar, one who was demon-possessed. And as such, some of them planned Muhammad's assassination, and he took this rejection as unbridled persecution, and this is what led to the flight to Medina. And it was in the year 622 that the first Muslim community was established in Medina. And that flight from Mecca to the city of Medina is known as the Hijra, the official beginning of Islam in the year 622 AD. And you need to remember that date because note also that Muslims use a different calendar than the rest of the world, using this date to mark the calendar starting point. So that was the 622 then was the year 1H after the Hijra. Therefore, they use that time to mark their calendar. Muhammad lived for another 10 years, died in 632 AD, which would be 10 AH. So we're going to stop there because we're out of time. And just again to see if there are any closing questions, I just want to make sure we're together on that. Yes? Mm-hmm.
Is there any evidence that Muhammad ever went to Jerusalem? Is Jerusalem ever mentioned in the Quran?
First of all, there's no evidence that he ever went there. That's not in the Quran. The Quran never says that. It's a later tradition. Secondly, Jerusalem is never mentioned in the Quran. It's not something that's a central city at all.
So the Dome of the Rock?
The Dome of the Rock is a later development that was, in fact, and one of the important principles that they would use is whenever a conquest would take place, they would take a central sanctuary, whatever it was, and then turn it into actually a mosque, and thus show that Islam trumps these other religions, and that Allah has the victory over those things. So the Dome of the Rock was a symbolic thing, and though it's not formally a mosque so much as a shrine, nevertheless, it was used as the place that commemorated the temple, in the Solomonic temple, saying that this has precedence, so this was not accidental. Same thing happened with Hagia Sophia. You all familiar with that? Hagia Sophia in Istanbul. It was then became a mosque, and the significant mosque there today. And so this was not accidental. It was used kind of like a statement, effectively. Yes?
Kim, why do you think Muhammad was able to get so many followers so quickly?
It's stunning, the last 10 years of his life, how many followers he had. And we're going to talk about that when we can complete the history next week and talk a little bit about that, because he had tremendous charisma and authority, and he could really rally people together, ground in this ideology, and give them a vision for something greater than they had known. But more than that, what's interesting is that after his death, that's when it really exploded. His vision was the whole area of what we would now call Saudi Arabia. That's what he expected. But instead, it took over Africa and went, and it exploded wildly in the next few decades. So that has reasons as well, and we'll explore that together too. Yes, last question, yes.
Is it true that Muslims believe that their children are born without sin?
Is it true that the Muslims born, that their children are born without sin? You need to understand, this is very important for us to grasp, that the basic doctrine of not just Islam, but of the other religions, is that people are basically good. And that only Christianity teaches that it's from the heart of man that the evil comes. Jesus was very, very opposed to this more religious notion, and also more recently humanism, that says people are basically good. Bear in mind, if the problem's in the human heart, there's no hope, unless there's a Savior. Do you see the concept there? Unless someone takes the guilt upon him, himself, and that therein lies the difficulty. So the answer would be, yes, people would be regarded as basically good. Otherwise, they're not savable. They would have no hope, no possibility. Yes?
I mean that it's all about works.
Always about works. And so, and I've studied religions for many years. My second book, which came out, gosh, I'm an old man now, came out in 1977, was called Cults, World Religions, and the Occult. And it was very, very clear that though there were so many variations, it was always over the same theme, salvation by works. Everyone. Not one exception, except for Christianity. Grace through faith is utterly, completely unique. And it's important for us to see this, because you see, if you do not have a Savior who says, I will take your guilt upon me, then what hope would you have if not works? And the expectation is normally that the good works would outweigh the bad. Let me conclude with this story. When Karen and I were in Egypt during all these uprisings, we got outside of Cairo a few days before. We were in Luxor when it all hit on the 25th. So we were actually happily going down the Nile River. We weren't there in Cairo when the demonstrations took place. But one of the themes that I saw again and again in all their temples, their shrines, and so forth, were the ideas of the afterlife and about judgment and about the fact that Anubis and Horus and the others would actually have this scale. And in that scale, they'd have a feather, and they would have the heart of the person who was being judged. He'd go up these steps to judgment. And if the heart and the feather matched, he would then be allowed to go in. Well, here's an interesting thing, though. So it would mean then if a person's works were basically a little bit better than his evil, you know, the good was better than the evil, you come in there. Try that with a cop when you say, you know, okay, I know I was driving 100 miles an hour in a 50, but, you know, generally speaking, I'm a good driver, and I more often than not stay within the driving the limits. How will that go over? You with me here? One act would be enough to condemn you. This whole idea of it being on a scale would be to invite God to say, okay, come on in. I know you're only 49% evil, so just don't let me catch you. I mean, that's just not the way it works. So thus, the gospel is based on the bad news first. Paul spends no less than 3 chapters in Romans developing the bad news so that we're ready to hear the good news. The bad news is we all fall short. The good news is that God well knows us, loves us anyway, and has actually embraced us. And that's the difference. Let me close in a prayer, and we'll pick this up next week. Lord, we thank you for this time together, and we ask that you would guide us into the truth. Give us a love for people who need Jesus. We pray in his name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.